Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, welcome to Nature Now. This is your host, Mary Robson, and today, Robert Michael Pyle joins us to share his insights, his poetry, and his conservation ethic. Many of you know his butterfly guidebooks, the book Wintergreen, and the book Where Bigfoot Walks. We will listen to him for the entire show, which makes all of us very fortunate.
When the autumn tides arrive each year, big waves come ashore and wash the beach like a giant sponge. Come winter, the storms hit harder yet and scrape the shoreline clean. When the big wave comes, when the big wave comes, the valleys beyond and the hills above are jealous of that seaside purging. They abide and imagine such a bath as would scour the cumbered continent free of its dirty old blot. When the big wave comes, when the big wave comes. But when the plates finally slip, as plates will do, and the big wave comes ashore, all insults will be washed away and the land again come clean. When the big wave comes, when that big old mama wave comes, when that big wave comes on down, and after that wave, as Robinson Jeffers wrote, the humans will be fewer, the hawks more common, the rivers pure from mouth to source. And we'll know again at last what it's like to live on a coast made fresh once more. When the big wave comes. When the big wave comes. When the big wave.
Hi. Welcome, Bob.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you for having me back to the radio station.
I am pretty excited about this. I'm just going to start right in with a question about a way that you did a kind of phrasing. There is a book which is called Through a Green Lens. There's a subtitle that says 50 Years of Writing for Nature.
Right.
And any other writer might have said about. So I thought maybe you could tell us how four carries out the themes of your writing, your thoughts, how you see that word working. It's a short word.
It's a short word, and I think a powerful one. Thanks for asking. That took a lot of thought. These days, most nonfiction books of essay, I mean, that's almost duplicating itself, but it's not quite. The essay is a personal form that explicates the feelings and the opinions and the thoughts of the writer, which is not how we were taught essay in the 50s and 60s. We were taught exposition, but when you really learn what an essay is, it's a personal attempt, as it says in French,
to try
to tell something personal about the world. Most of my books have been books of essay. Not all of them are poetry and fiction as well, and science, but this book was a gathering of essays from 50 years. I have a second collection coming from Counterpoint this year called Nature Matrix, and it also goes back 50 years. Each of these begins with an essay that I wrote at the age of 18 or 19. They came forward to essays that have just been written now. And the question was, since most books of essay these days have a title, meant to be a punchy title, followed by a subtitle that tells a little about what it really is, what does one do for that subtitle? Well, we said, let's put the 50 years in there, because that's a little bit shocking that these 50 years of one person's work, and nature should probably be exemplified there after Through a Green Lens, just so we know we're talking about nature, although nature is, of course, everything, which is much of what I write about. And then what about the placement word? And you're right, most people would say writing about nature. But that's all writing. That's a point that I make. There is no writing in the world that's not about nature. There is nothing that is not nature. There's nothing that's not the environment. Writing about nature is a complete redundancy. Writing for nature is a different thing.
The
word "for" occurred to me that most of what I have done is some kind of a advocacy, either loud advocacy or quiet advocacy. And that's what the "for" connotes.
Advocacy. Okay. Which is really different than being somewhere who stands there and observes and says, I think I saw a raven this morning.
I do plenty of that, but I do it in the context of recognizing human culpability in change and what we might ought to be thinking about doing about it. I've always been a conservation activist since I was a teenager.
And that essentially places what you are writing now in the context of your values forever.
It does, really. I mean, those have evolved. I used to be a dualist like almost everyone else and think about nature and human affairs as if they were two different worlds. As a student conservationist at the University of Washington, much of what we did in fighting for the North Cascades National Park against the dams in the Grand Canyon, rescuing and taking over the Montlake dump on campus. And
which is, that's a wonderful story.
It is a good story.
It has become a site of conservation success.
It's one of the major intra-urban habitats in the country today. But it was a Noisham Marsh when we marched down and took it over. The other students on campus were taking over Lewis Hall and demanding peace and justice. And we were involved in that too during the Vietnam War. But we thought, you know, let's demand topsoil and trees and take over the marsh. It might work better.
In effect, the university had been using this remarkable spot at the edge of water as a place to dump things?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know the story very well.
Well, it's in simple terms, the sainted President Susilo of the UW in the 20s, for whom the Grand Susilo Library, I think one of the great buildings on the West Coast, is named, leased the University Marsh to the city of Seattle as a landfill in the 1920s. Now, those marshes were created at Union Bay and at Bothell and at Renton, a few other places, when the lake was lowered for the ship canal.
Okay.
In 1912. And the Renton one became Boeing, the Bothell one became a log dump, and the one on Union Bay was still a pretty decent little marsh into the 50s, which you can read about in a wonderful book called Union Bay, The Life of a City Marsh by Higman and Larrison.
Okay.
But when I read that in the 60s, you know how we all suffer from diminished baseline. I thought this marsh was a great place when I came in the mid-60s, and then I read about what it had been like in the 50s, and they wrote about what it had been like in the 20s, and I saw that dramatic declined, but we still used it a lot for natural history. The university, they were going to finish the dump first, it was almost entirely filled. It was full of gulls and rats and methane. And then they were going to cover it with light soil and make parking lots and playing fields out of the entire thing.
Which they have a lot of in that area.
They already have a lot down there in the golf course and so on, or the driving range. So 500 of us marched down there shortly after the first Earth Day. I was in the lead. And we had demanded trees and topsoil. They're a lot easier than peace and justice. So we got them from DNR and the university, and we went down there, staff, faculty, students, town activists, and we took it over. We took over the marsh. Well, that led to another half century of committee meetings and hard work, but it has become one of the great in-city habitats. When we were doing that sort of thing in North Cascades National Park, I too suffered from a sense of a dualism. You know, we were doing this because we were advocating nature over artifice.
Mm-hmm.
I no longer believe that. I believe that there is absolutely nothing but nature and environment, and that the most dangerous idea in the world is that there is some kind of a line between humans and the rest of nature. It doesn't change my activism.
Well, and that idea goes all the way back to the great chain of being in the medieval and Renaissance era, where once you got past the angels, you got to man, and then every other critter was stuck farther and farther and farther down the chain.
Exactly, and we got rid of that through the likes of Aldo Leopold and John Muir and John Steinbeck, all of whom talked about all there is all there is, until we finally come to Kurt Cobain, who put it in the most cogent and simplest, most direct way of all at the end of All Apologies in the Nirvana song, when he says, "All in all is all we are."
Well, so we have that intensity which carries forward through your work and your speaking, and the fact that you stand, to my mind, as someone who wraps your teaching in pictures and images that readers can enjoy.
Thank you. And in some cases, quite literally, such as with the field guides. My very first book was my master's thesis in the forestry school at the UW, which was a little book called Watching Washington Butterflies.
Oh.
And it was the first interpretive field guide to a region's butterflies in the country.
Well, most of of our listeners are probably familiar with your Butterflies of the Pacific Northwest. What interests me about that is to make that field guide more useful. You write historical essays, conditions of habitat, lots of information, which I consider sort of irresistible information. So instead of simply saying, this is an orange butterfly, we find ourselves stepping back in time to the people who first saw it, where they saw it, and it seems to me that you then also include the detail of your own encounters, so someone meets that butterfly at several different levels.
Quite right, and I this was very intentional. After my Watching Washington Butterflies field guide, I wrote the Audubon North American field guide, which was an enormous labor for a young man. And then later, Seattle Audubon wanted me to update the Washington book, and I said, only if I can do it as I want to, and it'll be the entire territory of Cascadia, much bigger book, and only if I can have fun. And by that, I mean, by this time, I was writing a lot of poetry and essay and fiction, and I said, only if I can have fun. So with the Butterflies of Cascadia, the big book that that became, I wrote two different species accounts for each butterfly. One was left brain in a certain typeface and font and color of print, and the other one was a right brain response, if you want to use those terms. But one was discursive and personal, and the other one was entirely fact-based, just the facts, ma'am, over here, so that you can consult those without having to wade through the other. But the other side, so you could read it in the camper waiting for the rain to stop or before the fire in the winter. And that worked very well. That was popular with people. And so when we revised Cascadia
into
a couple of years ago,
Butterflies of the Pacific Northwest.
Yes, the brand new Butterflies of the Pacific Northwest by Timber Press, with my co-author Caitlin Nabar, who handled all the wonderful new pictures and digital stuff, and I revised the text. I kept that essential format. And so you can, just as you described, I don't need to re-describe it, you get the facts that are reliable and up-to-date and pretty in-depth. And then you get the, what I like to think is the playful aspect, where, and including right up into poetry. So for example, with the Echo Azure butterfly, I quote Frost saying, with these sky flakes down in flurry on flurry, there is more undiluted color on the mud than there will be for flowers unless they hurry.
It's wonderful to hear a not usually quoted piece of Robert Frost. And I was thinking that takes us to being physically involved with what you are doing, I think, defines the way you learn. I mean, that may not be entirely true, but I remember reading about Parnassus Claudius, and you said, one male I netted had affixed to furry scales on its thorax a viable egg, which I took home and reared to the third instar. That's like reading, that's 13-level chess. You've got all kinds of things going on.
But it was a 13-level experience for me to be out with Tia in the mountains. We were near South Sister in Oregon, and the wonderful Clodius Parnassian butterfly, the hero of my chapter in Wintergreen called I, Clodius, which is a terrible pun, on Graves' I, Claudius, of course. But it's a wonderful big white waxy butterfly with cherry and ebony spots. Caterpillars feed on wild bleeding hearts. And I was looking for the mountain Parnassian that's never been found in Oregon, or not in the Cascades, that is. And we were up quite high on the Sister, and I thought, maybe this will be the other species after all. But then I saw a little dwarf bleeding heart. I said, no, it's going to be Clodius. And it was Clodius, but the great surprise was here was an egg caught on the fur of the male. And it did turn out to be viable, and I reared it partway. I only wish I had gotten it all the way through. I was stupid and reared it. It was a cold spring, and I didn't bring it. If I brought it into the warmth, I might have gotten it all the way through.
Just briefly, though, when you have acquired an egg of that level of fragility, how do you get it home? You took it home, it says, but I'm thinking, in what? How? How did you do that?
I put the butterfly in a jar and kept it in the cooler so it was still...
Oh. Okay.
And couldn't flap around and hurt anything. And then I finally, at home, under magnification, I very delicately, probably with a camel hair brush, removed the egg from its own vestiture and put it onto a little leaf of bleeding heart, and it started feeding.
For those of you who don't know,
and then started feeding.
Native bleeding heart is an extremely attractive substrate for that particular type of butterfly.
Yes,
right?
It's required.
Most of the Parnassus butterflies, or
no? That's the interesting thing about this genus. They're called Parnassus because of Mount Parnassus, a home of the gods, of course. Most of them live in the high mountains. The most famous is called Apollo, and it lives in the Alps, where it's endangered. But that species and our mountain Parnassian, which is up in the Cascades and the Olympics, in fact, has a subspecies name of Olympianus, it's endemic there. Those feed as caterpillars on stone crop, sedum, and only on that. And that's highly distasteful, and their red spots on their wings are aposematic warning coloration for
just
predators.
Just don't eat me.
Yeah, because I'm going to taste really crabby. And but this one species, well, actually a very small number of species in the northern hemisphere, have adapted from stone crop onto bleeding hearts and ram's horns and their close relatives down near the coast. There's even a subspecies named Shepherdi for the great lepidopterist John Shepherd that lives in Hell's Canyon, that dry country over there. But when there is some rain in the spring, a species of bleeding heart relative named ram's horn blooms very briefly. It cannot imagine it has enough biomass for these rather big butterflies. But you look later and it's all dried out and you can't find the plant, you can't find anything. But during that brief effulgence in the springtime, the adults have found the plant and they use that. So that one group of Parnassians uses the bleeding hearts and the other group uses stone crop.
Well, I'm thinking that this leads us to the question of what I think is very important to how you communicate, which is the power of description. And I am considering a phrase from The Thunder Tree, which is nearly autobiographical. Not completely, but nearly.
Largely.
But
excuse me, Mary.
Yeah.
It's really a memoir of the place.
Yes.
Illuminated by my stories rather than the other way around. That's
well, and it also contributes to our knowledge that the natural places we grow up in as children and adolescents never leave our lives.
That's right.
And this is the sentence I really wanted to go into. Season by season, the sinuous rows of trees grew from sprouts into monuments. I love this because all of a sudden you're thrown into a completely different world just by that description. Thank so you. This, I think, is what is lively about the poetry in your writing, and I wondered if you wanted to go on from there.
Thank you very much. First, specifically about cottonwoods in Colorado, and after I left my family in the Springs and was going up to the airport, I can't manage Denver much anymore, and so I always go out east on the plains and then come into Denver International from the east side, totally skipped the city where I grew up. So just ago, I was camping in a cottonwood grove east of Denver Airport before taking off in the morning. I love those prairie cottonwoods. I love those prairie ditches. That's what this book, The Thunder Tree, is about. And of course, the Thunder Tree itself was one grand cottonwood hollow that saved my life and the life of my brother in a devastating prairie hailstorm that killed six cattle in the field next to us by breaking their backs with hail the size of melons. And we were saved because my brother hauled me into the hollow cottonwood tree. So naturally it became the icon of our lives and the center of our universes. And those cottonwoods have always been very close to my heart. I always go see them.
Had they changed color already when you saw them now?
Yeah, I was getting some pretty good color. I'd come down to the Springs from Estes Park, where I was attending a reunion through the mountains. So I got through absolutely superb aspen going south. Pretty darn good cottonwood color going north. They're in the same genus, of course, Populus. And skipped Denver both ways, which I considered a great coup. Not that I don't like parts of that city still, but it's just so hard, like Seattle, to penetrate, you know. So the cottonwoods are very, very dear to me. And consequently, I've tried in many ways to depict them. And I'm glad that you find my descriptive language honoring them. In that same passage, or another passage in the book about my mother and her life and her death, the cottonwoods play a very, very large role too. And in the hailstorm, when I describe that and coming out of it, the smell and the sound of the tattoo on the cottonwood and the smell of the charred cottonwood inside, it's so close to my heart. And I feel that the bond that any writer, not just a nonfiction writer, but a poet and a novelist has with the reader is to convey the world with such particularity and personality that the reader can feel as if she or he has been there.
And remains there from the wonderful ability to turn back to the page and look again.
That's right.
And take it in again.
That's exactly right. And they know that they'll find that. This sounds pretentious as heck. My friend Florence Sage, a wonderful poet in Astoria, challenged us both to read all of Shakespeare this year. Well, she's not doing it, but I am. I'm reading my grandmother's all the way through. I've only got five plays days left, and I'm going to have serious withdrawal when I finish. But what I'm finding is not only that author, whomever he was, I think it was Shakespeare, is actually in touch with every single human foible ever invented, mm-hmm. and has got its number, got their number, but also the descriptive powers are that of some of my most beloved modern writers, because he too was extraordinarily attentive to his immediate surroundings, whether they were courts or Athenian settings, or in common cases, the natural world.
I think that one of the reasons that people try to say that Shakespeare couldn't possibly have written these is that we weren't there with him. And the people who read him properly are so astonished that they say this couldn't have been done by a regular human being.
I mean, why not say that about Kesey and Sometimes a Great Notion? Why not say that about Wallace Stegner and The Angle of Repose? How could a human being have written those? How could one person have written those? Of course, they had grand educations. In fact, Kesey studied with Stegner, funnily enough. Well, take a massive intellect, which the author obviously had, and take a very close connection with the countryside and the city, mm-hmm. and then take a decent education and the ability to read in a very rich literature mm-hmm. at the time. Why not?
Well, quite often, I think, particularly in the 19th century, the King James Bible and Shakespeare may have been the only books in a house.
And that's a good question. And a recent book by my publisher, my current publisher is Counterpoint Press, and they published a very interesting book called Shakespeare's Library. And it's partly saying, well, where was his library? Where is his library? But also, what would have been in it? Fascinating mm-hmm. book. And you know that much of his library was the world.
Well, that, you know, that's
observant.
Rather fortunately brings us back to the question. Good work. I think that one of the things about the way that you have written is that, as you said, there's no space between the scientific and the artistic, although both disciplines have in the past had their way of looking at things. You had to do science by following a certain pattern of observation, replication, etc. Art was often dismissed as unnecessary to humans, or even perhaps now. But true in your prose is that poetry comes along constantly, and I think that poetry is about both surprise and challenge, and that's what brings those two levels together. And I was wondering if you would, at this point, help us by reading a poem from the book called Chinook and Chanterelles, and tell us a little bit about the book and read a poem.
Thank you. I'll do that. Before I do, may I just say one word of response about what you just said about bringing them together and evoke one more giant, one more seemingly superhuman giant, and that's Vladimir Nabokov,
okay.
who, of course, was a model of mine as a lepidopterist because he did superb butterfly studies, which have been vindicated lately for some of their iconoclastic conclusions.
He started that as a child in Russia.
He did indeed, and after his family had to flee, first of all, from the revolution, secondly, from Crimea, from the Bolsheviks, and thirdly, from Germany, because Vera, his wife, was Jewish. So three refugee situations, finally ended up in New England, curating butterflies at Harvard and teaching a bit at Wellesley, and finally his mm-hmm. career at Cornell. Then came Lolita and the rest of his life as the
But initially, he was a lepidopterist.
Very that much was, so, and, yeah. and he remained that throughout his life. Published a lot. So in my big book that I edited with Brian Boyd on mm-hmm. Nabokov's butterflies, I include actually some of his scientific writings as well as his butterfly writings in poetry and fiction and essay, because he managed to do just what you said, which is to integrate artistic, imaginative writing into scientific mm-hmm. papers, because it was as precise as his measurements. And he had genius editors who let him do that. Almost no one's ever gotten away with that. Well, Nabokov, as I learned compiling that great tome, Nabokov's Butterflies, adhered to a hypothesis of his, really, that he stated in a book review quite clearly, a book review of Audubon's paintings of butterflies, which most people don't know he even did. But Nabokov reviewed this obscure book in the New York Times Book Review, and during that review, he said, "Does there not exist a high ridge where the mountainside of scientific knowledge meets the opposite slope of artistic imagination?"
That and, turned I mean, up bingo. In your book, Walking the High Ridge.
That's right. It's turned up in almost everything I've written since. In both cases, he puts scientific and artistic in quotation marks, as if to diminish their duality. And he really believed that, and he lived that way, and it's that high ridge that I've aspired toward. That's why I call that book Walk in the High Ridge. Mm-hmm. So this poem is an attempt to bring closely observed natural history that you could call scientific in its degree of detail, together with an imaginative approach to these organisms. It's in my third collection of poems. The earlier full-size collection was called Evolution of the Genus Iris, and this one is called Chinook and Chanterelle. And I wrote the title poem for my late wife, Tia, when she was first taken ill back in about 2004. And we met in a mushroom class at the University of Washington.
That's wonderful.
In 1967. And she was the best chanterelle hound in the county. I tell you, I wouldn't want to be a chanterelle when Tia was around. So I wrote this for her. And I hope this will prove an example of trying to look at the world both ways and to integrate them through on the high ridge. Because don't we all want to live a bonded life where we can access both our imaginative and our analytical sides? Why live with one arrow in your quiver, one hand tied behind your back? Chinook and Chanterelle for Tia. What gifts these are from river and woods, these coral ones, muscled strumpets plucked from the fisher's nets where the shrunken runs still shine. And these golden ones, fluted trumpets pinched from the forest floor where the second growth hemlocks still stand. Surely, we are unworthy of these. But if enjoyment of succulent flesh is any mitigation, if the tongue's fierce possession of taste can be extenuation, if the way we chew and praise and slurp and swallow and say it, worship this fin and stipe, these silver scales and meaty caps, can sing the hard shimmer in the stream, can cry the soft glimmer on the mossy floor, can save us. If these gestures make any difference whatsoever, well, then maybe we deserve them after all.
There are no words that follow that well, except that those of you who have been able to hear it can't look at a chanterelle the same way. Can't look at a piece of salmon you're about to cook.
That's my hope. My other hope is that people who don't tend to read poetry might realize that a lot of our wonderful contemporary poets, Tim McNulty, Holly Hughes, mm-hmm. lots of people, are writing stories and they're writing slices of life that will enrich and delight them and seek poetry out. And of course, you have Copper Canyon right here.
There is not a standard for hiding your poem in the old forms. No. Which tended to obscure things if you weren't used to reading them. Thank you for reading that.
And the old forms can be fresh, too. I just last week wrote a blank verse. Well, I'm influenced by my Shakespeare reading, of course, wrote a blank verse poem with a rhymed couplet at the end that I didn't expect to go that way, but it went that way as I wrote it. But it was similarly combined of elements of a natural experience. I should acknowledge, by the way, that both of these collections of mine are published by Lost Horse Press,
okay.
which, along with your own Copper Canyon and a few others, are wonderful Northwest poetry publishers. We're
right.
gifted with a splendid poetry tradition in the Northwest.
Well, and at this point, your poetry is being set to music, but I wondered, how did it come to happen that you have poems with musical accompaniment? How is this satisfactory? It's a completely new direction in people being able to access your work. Right.
But the fact is, I don't take rapid turns. Most of these things have been in the works for a while. So this collection of poems and music, that's been 10 years in the works. It came about in the following way. A little earlier, I referenced Kurt Cobain. Mm-hmm. When Kurt Cobain died, his bandmate and co-founder of Nirvana, Chris Novoselic, the bassist of Nirvana, mm-hmm. Was devastated, and he moved out to a farm in the country that he had earlier acquired, which is just one ridge away from mine. So we became involved together in local conservation issues, fighting roadside spraying, protecting old-growth forest, did a few things like that together, and then we both belonged to the Grange, the patrons of husbandry, and he's become the master of our Grange, like the president president. And so he knew that that organization had been a powerful force in community and could be again. Christ is nothing if not a communitarian. He had a radio show on another small community radio station in Astoria called KMUN. Played all vinyl, all eclectic, everything except Nirvana. And one night he did a mashup of Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, being read by, I think, Ed Begley Sr. or maybe Orson Welles, and John Fahey's wonderful side guitar music. Now, Chris would bring his acoustic guitar to Grange every week. Mm-hmm. He didn't bring his bass and rock out, you know, but we'd sing Home on the Range and Happy Trails and things. And so I said, Chris, bring your guitar. You play some Fahey-type stuff, and I'll read some Leaves of Grass, and we'll do that for the program at the Grange. And Chris said, well, that's cool, except the heck with that. Let's compose our own. This is over 10 years ago. Wow. And so he composed, this is not waffling, noodling music in the background of my poems. These are fully composed guitar songs, complex. Mm-hmm. So he composed a song, I composed the lyric, and we put them together and the match was astonishingly close. We did, of course, monkey with it and alter it to some degree. But we recorded that quite a while back. It's been on YouTube for a long time. And that's the one called Notes from the Edge of the Known World. We had such fun that he said, let's do more. And I said, what do you want to do next? And he said, well, he was studying, going to college at the time. You know, the boys in Nirvana never had time to go to college. So he was going to college and he graduated with distinction from WSU. But he was studying geology at the time. And he said, I'm loving the geology. Let's do a geology song. So I wrote a song called Brett's Floods about the glacial Lake Missoula floods that shaped our region. And he loved that story. So he wrote a wonderful guitar song for that. And we kept going. We have a tsunami song, global warming song, but these are not preachy. These are not, they're poetry on many different subjects. The Return of the Swallows. There's one heartbreaker about a road-killed baby bear. And that's how it got going. And now we finished 11 of them and they're being released.
That is completely fascinating. And it gives those of us who appreciate and live with your writing a new way to do it. We are sliding toward the end of the time we've been talking. And I wanted to ask you something about your novel, Magdalena Mountain, talking about Colorado's butterfly, the Magdalena, dark, 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 with very
all
little,
black.
All black.
All black butterfly in the world.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yes.
And it is alpine. And I wondered how, given that you wrote about humans, how is it creating a whole person? I wonder if it's a little bit like describing a butterfly with just different parts.
Well, I thought it might be that when I began it, but it's a lot more complicated than that when you get to dialogue and you get to trying to develop actual actual people that the reader can believe in. And this is why writing this novel was my apprenticeship in fiction. I wrote and published short fiction along the way. But Mary, I started this novel in 1974. So when people say, why did you switch over to fiction from nonfiction?
It was not a switch.
It wasn't a switch. I've been writing this novel for over 40 years. And I wrote 10 complete drafts.
Oh my gosh.
Came very close to publishing with Houghton Mifflin at one time, very close with Milkweed at one time. Fortunately, they did not publish those books. But I got such good editorial input finally from Milkweed and then from my friend Florence Sage. Those were the readings I needed to complete the 10th draft, which is the one that clicked, and it was published by Jack Shoemaker at Counterpoint Press.
2018?
I'm correct, just a year ago.
Okay.
And it's been a great joy for me to have this finally come to pass. And that it is a fully developed human story, but the butterfly story, the Black Magdalena Alpine butterfly, goes through its life during the book, too, in short chapters. So I've tried to write classic nature writing integrated with a fully punchy human story to try to capture both kinds of readers. And the butterfly becomes a kind of a machine ex-deus for causing the action to occur.
I think we could record for 3 hours a week for the next 30 years. There's so much to talk about.
And I
very much appreciate this. And I think that your comments about the Magdalena Butterfly and Magdalena Mountain bring us around to the circle we started with, which is how can people meeting your writing and your approach live with nature in a different way. I really appreciate it. And I'm very grateful that you've been here to tell us this.
Thank you, Mary. Your questions are wonderfully astute. And again, they honor me and what I'm trying to do. And I thank you for that.
Well,
thank you to the radio station
as
well. Yes,
thank you to all parts of everything that we have done today. That's it for this remarkable edition of Nature Now. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Alex Henley for superb editing. Nature Now plays at noon on Wednesdays,
5 o'clock Thursdays, and 12:30 Saturdays, with podcasts at www.kptz.org.
At the top of the forest that used to be, a spar pole stands that makes logs fly as they never could before, just rooted in the ground. Spar poles once were trees themselves. One tall, straight fir could lord it over all the other trees in the wood until the others were all gone. The high climber made spar poles. Climb the tallest tree, bucking limbs as he went. 200 feet straight up, and then he topped the tree. Leaned against his belt at the top of the world, took in the view, hoping the belt wouldn't slip, hoping the trees would last forever. Now, the tall trees all gone. Sparkles are towers of steel, and the second growth dances to diesel instead of steam. High riggers drop leads from the sky. Choker setters fix cables to logs. And then, if the chokers hold, the trees get to fly all the way up to the landing. Now that pole on the horizon, the beeps of the whistle bug, the saws of the fallers, they're all signs that the trees are still flying off the land. And then, all of a sudden, a butterfly floats over the show, looking for a place to light. A flower, a meadow, maybe a tree. But what's this? Far above the stumps below, a shiny cap on a shiny tree that has cables for branches. As good a place as any, she thinks, to bask, to rest, to take in the view. The rigger sees her land. He thinks it's a spark in the hot high leads. Hope they don't shut us down, he says, or put us on hoot owl this damn early. Well, people and jobs fly off the hills too, as more machines move in, as trees run out. But all that flies away, they say, comes back around in the end. And that butterfly launching from the spar pole? Why, that's just a promise that the land lives on, that the trees still grow, that the forest will be back one day, no matter what.